It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We unpack the welfare fraud scandal now that's swirling in Mississippi and the connection to Packers legendary retired NFL Hall of Fame quarterback Brett Favre. The nonprofit newsroom, Mississippi Today, obtained text messages that connected the dots, showing how Favre pressed welfare officials to steer taxpayer money to his projects. Call in about Brett Favre's legacy. What you wonder about the litigation in his home state, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Wolf is an investigative reporter writing about poverty and economic justice for Mississippi Today. Anna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, how has former Packers quarterback Brett Favre become a central figure, as you put it, in Mississippi's welfare scandal?
Well, you know, this actually dates back more than 2 years. So back in 2020, the auditor's office had done an investigation and arrested six people in connection with the embezzlement of these welfare funds from a federal program called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. At that time, we were able to connect Brett Favre to the scheme because the indictments listed a company that had received some of this money. It didn't take too much research to find that Brett Favre was kind of a spokesperson for this company called Prevacus, a pharmaceutical company. And so we requested emails from the Department of Human Services, the welfare department, that referenced Brett Favre and found that he was actually meeting with the governor and welfare officials regarding getting grant funds to this company that eventually ended in, you know, criminal indictments for a few individuals. After that, we realized that welfare money had actually also gone to a volleyball stadium at University of Southern Mississippi, his alma mater, and where his daughter played volleyball. And we were able to tie that back to him. And this was, again, back in 2020. The auditor then included Brett Favre in his audit report that came out in May of 2020, finding that he had actually also received $1 million himself to do kind of promotional activities, radio ads, that kind of thing for the welfare program. You know, it's been kind of 2 years trying to pull strings and figure out what else happened. And it wasn't until this year that we uncovered text messages that showed that the governor was even more involved than we realized in each of those deals.
This is getting more complicated, more people being pulled into this. But going back to kind of the beginning, Favre becomes a kind of spokesperson for a company marketing a drug to treat concussions. Just a little bit more there. How does that piece fit into the embezzlement scheme?
Yeah, that was actually kind of the first clue that we had back in the indictments in 2020. One of the things that this nonprofit founder, Nancy New, was charged with was making personal investments in this pharmaceutical company with welfare money. So that's obviously illegal. You can't, you know, take public funds and convert them to your personal use to make investments in a, you know, for-profit company. We found out later that Nancy New was actually discussing this project with Brett Favre, sort of how the genesis of this funding got to the company was a meeting at Brett Favre's house with Nancy New, the welfare director, John Davis, and the founder of the company.
Explain what we just referred to it as this welfare money is. And you mentioned TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Why is this money vulnerable to like misuse, manipulation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Temporary Assistance for Needy Families is the program that a lot of people would recognize as the welfare check. So it provides direct cash assistance to very, very poor families. It was created in the 90s during welfare reform under Bill Clinton. And at that time, when they wrote it into law, their idea was that states should have broad flexibility to spend this money. It's a block grant. Any way that they see fit to help people in poverty, right? So it doesn't have to go to cash assistance. It can go to other kinds of anti-poverty programs like parenting classes or, you know, anti-teen pregnancy prevention or fatherhood programs, these kinds of things. And so you kind of saw in Mississippi and in other states that over time, the goals of the program kind of got distorted over time, and officials found that they could spend the money on these other ancillary things that, you know, might make their politically connected cronies happy.
Like a volleyball stadium?
Like a volleyball stadium, exactly.
So you look at these text messages suggesting that the former Mississippi governor, Phil Bryant, helped Brett Favre gather these federal dollars for this volleyball stadium at the very college where Favre's daughter played. So, you know, how is that possible? How does Favre realize what this money is and that it's not for volleyball stadiums?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's something that I've been asked a lot. You know, it's like, did Favre know that this is TANF money? And my response to that is like, do we think that Favre knows what TANF is? What is important is that he knew that he had to kind of finagle the purpose of this grant and the purpose of this building in order to satisfy federal regulations, right? So they couldn't just say it was a volleyball stadium. They were calling it a wellness center. And they said that the building was going to serve underprivileged families by holding rallies and maybe having some office space in the building where people could come get services. But all of those ideas were kind of vague and fuzzy and clearly not intentional, and not the purpose of helping families, but of building this volleyball stadium that Brett Favre wanted to see at his alma mater.
We're talking about Packers legend Brett Favre and Mississippi's ongoing welfare scandal with Anna Wolf. She is an investigative reporter with the nonprofit newsroom Mississippi Today that had broke the story, has been covering it all along through recent years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Questions you have and how you feel about Brett Favre's legacy. So, Anna, you know, as this becomes more and more connected to other people. I mean, you've looked at court documents and thousands of pages of emails and text messages. And authorities say it's painting a picture of the largest public embezzlement scheme in Mississippi history. So other than Favre, who is implicated in the scandal?
Yeah, so there is a lot of misconceptions about this case because there is such a big number of almost $100 million that was misspent here, according to the state auditor. And that is made up of a huge list of purchases that auditors found violated federal regulations around TANF, right? So that could be something as simple as like TANF money went to an after-school program or like a sports camp that maybe served kids who didn't fall under a certain income threshold, right? So it violated TANF regs because it did not serve needy families. So the list goes from anything as sort of like non-nefarious as that to something as egregious as a volleyball stadium or investments in this pharmaceutical company, and anything in between, right? So you've got other athletes who have been implicated here. The family of Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man WWE wrestler, him and his sons received a total of around $5 million from the welfare program. And that was to, they said, provide services and programming to like inner city youth in Jackson. And there's very little evidence of those services, very little evidence of like who they actually helped with that $5 million. There was another athlete, Marcus Dupree, who the nonprofit actually purchased a horse ranch for that he's currently living at through his foundation. So, I mean, it's kind of a laundry list if you go through and just look at like all of these, you know, we paid lobbyists, we bought vehicles. I say we, I mean, you know, the welfare program through this nonprofit that was supposed to be running this sort of public-private partnership that would, they said, wrap around families to provide services, you know, to the family as a whole. And we saw that really what that meant was benefiting their friends and family.
Anna Wolf is an investigative reporter for Mississippi Today, which has been uncovering new details and breaking stories about Mississippi's welfare system scandal, with retired Packers quarterback Brett Favre being a central figure. Call in about the scheme and how you view Favre now, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into how Packers legendary retired quarterback Brett Favre is a key figure in his home state of Mississippi's ongoing welfare scandal. The nonprofit newsroom Mississippi Today, they broke the story on this welfare scheme over 2 years ago. Join in with your questions about the millions of dollars in welfare misspending, your views on Favre's involvement, 800-642-1234. Anna Wolf is an investigative reporter for Mississippi Today and stays with us. Let's take a call now. Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been trying to follow the story since this first happened, and I will say, in all due respect to your guest, I am still utterly confused in terms of what Brett Favre did that was illegal. It seems like he was an advocate for a volleyball stadium to be built in Mississippi for the betterment of Mississippi. If there's crimes that occurred, the crimes are by government officials. So I don't see why we're attacking an advocate who was trying to do what he thought was in the best interest of Mississippi. Help me understand that.
Steve, thank you. Anna.
Yeah, so the civil suit that the Department of Human Services has filed against, you know, this huge list of people, including Brett Favre, says that Favre knew that what the welfare officials were doing and that he was encouraging them to do was a sham to cover up the fact that Favre had actually personally committed $5 million or however many millions to build this volleyball stadium. And instead of paying for it himself, he solicited the money from other areas, including the welfare department. So in this case, the significance of that allegation is that the state is saying that he made a personal guarantee to construct the volleyball stadium, and in soliciting welfare money was actually able to, you know, benefit himself by relieving himself of that responsibility. You know, that allegation, that civil charge against him says that he understood that grant funds provided by DHS could not be used for brick and mortar, and so that he was a character within this scheme to convert the money in that way. Now, these are civil charges. So, you know, what he did, what they're alleging that he did, was allegedly illegal, but not criminal, right? He hasn't been charged criminally. There has been someone else that has actually already pleaded guilty to defrauding the government related to his involvement in this scheme, but Favre has not been charged criminally.
How is public opinion of Brett Favre being affected in Mississippi since his involvement in the scandal?
No, I think that a lot of people here locally, you know, sort of know his reputation as sort of being kind of cheap and being politically connected. And so it's not that big of a surprise to a lot of people. But other people are certainly disappointed that he would be involved in something that smells this bad.
I think you've called him Mississippi's favorite son before. And that, I would imagine, then is quite a blow to have him so wrapped up in this.
Yeah, certainly. For the people who sort of like the caller just now, you know, want to see him in a certain light and want to defend, you know, what he did, there's certainly that sentiment out there.
Favre has yet to grant an interview to Mississippi Today, but I think you've exchanged a text message or two. If you, like, had the opportunity to sit down with Favre, what would you ask?
I think I would ask more specifically, you know, what his conversations were like with these folks, and sort of like when he texted the nonprofit founder, you know, can anyone find out where this money came from, which was a text that we found. You know, what was his mentality behind that? And when they said, you know, we have to pretend like this building is going to serve underprivileged people, like, how did he sort of reconcile that in his mind, knowing that all along the real purpose was to have a new state-of-the-art volleyball facility at his alma mater's campus?
It just still baffles me how Favre could wield so much power and influence over how government welfare money is spent, how his connections could make such an impact. How is that possible with federal government money?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, that the people who were running the state and running this welfare program were sort of so wrapped up in and they just wanted celebrity around them. They exalted celebrity and what those celebrities could provide to them. And when we saw them, being influenced very heavily by not just Brett Favre, but these wrestlers, right? And these other athletes that they just wanted to be close to because it made them feel important and because it elevated their stature. And it's just kind of it's disappointing to know that there are people running the state who that is sort of their main motive, right? And not serving the people that they're tasked to serve in the poorest state in the country, by the way.
Anna Wolf, investigative reporter with the nonprofit newsroom Mississippi Today, as we talk about Packers legend Brett Favre, Mississippi's ongoing welfare scandal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Anna, what can other states, including here in Wisconsin, what can we learn from what Mississippi is reckoning with?
I think that it's a huge indictment on the block grant structure, right? That the federal government is doling out millions and millions of dollars to each state without really asking the state to provide evidence back to the federal government about how they're spending the money, and especially how how the programs that they are spending money on are actually helping people. This program is meant to draw people out of poverty, right? And I mean that I there's it's one of the most important goals, I would think, of certainly this department and of the government. And the federal government doesn't ask the state to provide any evidence that they're actually doing that or to fund, evidence-based programs that would actually reduce poverty in states like Mississippi, where that is such a problem that we face.
Let's bring in Tom in Madison. Tom, what's coming up for you?
Oh, good morning. I clearly concur that the federal government needs to put stricter rules in place here, but I think that this entire scheme was cooked up by the Mississippi Republican Party, which is basically opposed to welfare in any form to begin with, and that Brett Favre was a celebrity spokesperson for it. However, I don't view him as an innocent party. I think once the money started moving past him, he was interested in more money for his pet projects. It's unfortunate insofar as his judgment may be clouded by too many hard tackles in football, but that doesn't take away his civil and/or criminal liability here.
Tom, thank you. Anna, what do you think of that framing, that lens to look through?
Yeah, I mean, I just talked about how lax the federal rules are, and I've always said though that it wouldn't matter that the rules are so lax if Mississippi actually cared about its people, right? If it actually cared about doling out money in a way that would help people and transform lives, then it wouldn't matter how few regulations there are on the money. And yeah, I think he's noting that Brett Favre has responsibility here. He isn't a government official, as the previous caller mentioned. But he wields a lot of influence, and in this case, he wielded his influence to divert money away from people that needed it and to the projects that he wanted for whatever personal reason that he had. The pharmaceutical company that he helped usher funds to, he was going to profit from eventually. That was the goal. He was invested in that company, and that company getting its, you know, drug trials off the ground was eventually going to earn him money in the long run, you know, millions of dollars he projected. So, so that kind of gives you some insight into, you know, what he had to gain here.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Anna Wolf is an investigative reporter for Mississippi Today, the state's first nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom. We have a link to their coverage landing page called Mississippi Welfare. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We navigate year-end giving now when countless nonprofits get in their last burst of fundraising in the calendar year. But how do you know if your donation is well spent? Call in with questions about evaluating charities and nonprofits, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Thatcher is president and CEO of Charity Navigator, which independently rates about 200,000 charities to determine their effectiveness. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, I'm really happy to be here. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. So there are roughly 1.8 million nonprofit organizations in our country. That's the Urban Institute running those numbers. But what should people know about a nonprofit before giving them money?
I think the probably at the simplest level, you want to know it's a nonprofit, right? And you really want to just, if you're wanting to make a charitable gift to a charitable organization, know it's a legitimate 501c3 charity, and that you'll get the tax break on your donation. Simplest way to do that is just look them up on a service like Charity Navigator, or even on the IRS's website. There's a charity search that they have, and it lets you know that it's legitimate. That's the first step. The second step would be to find out, you know, the other thing I think is probably the most important thing. It's, are you aligned with how they're addressing the problem you're seeking to make a difference in? And so part of that is looking at, what is their mission? Are you aligned with it? Is it real? You know, and then do they have the means of doing it? So are they responsible in how they're spending their money? Are they accountable? Do they, you know, transparent in what they're doing? And then are they able to tell you that they're making a difference? So the real sort of the articulated impact of the organization, not just the problem, right? Remember, a lot of times you get a really great description of a really dire situation.
Yes.
But you want to know that they're making a difference with that situation, not just that the problem's bad.
Which leads me to think about how our mailbox at home is just, you know, inundated this time of year with those end of year appeals and this, you know, those stories about what the problem is or what the problems a charity is addressing. So when I open up and read this literature, what should I look for in these solicitations?
I mean, what I would do is take the solicitation as an invitation to do a little bit of research. And so let's say one of the mailings you get really speaks to you, and like it triggers you, and you're like, I want to do something about this. I would then look up the organization. Don't necessarily take their word for it. Go to a third party neutral platform. Essentially, what, you know, Charity Navigator is a free service, so we're not charging you to come and look up a charity. You can take the name of the organization that you got in the mail, plug in their name in our search, and we'll give you information on it based on our ratings. And our ratings are looking at four key areas. One, we want to know that they have a strength of leadership and accountability or adaptability. We look at their finances and accountability practices. We get this data from their tax forms. We also look at something that we're calling culture and community, which is how they engage with the people they serve, how they also treat their people internally, so more equity practices within the organization. And then finally, when we're able to do it, we're going to actually tell you what the cost per outcome they are able to produce and how effective that is. And so that's a lot of additional information that you're definitely not going to get in a postcard mailing or even a lengthier mailing. And it's coming through sort of a neutral third party, because that's really our role, is to not put our own biases into the situation, but we're treating organizations fairly and equitably in how we're trying to come up with an assessment.
I want to talk about the last thing you said there, the cost per outcome, because we often hear about charity overhead and that formula, mm-hmm. the costs of running the operation versus the money, you know, coming in to help the organization or you know, its mission. Are overhead costs a guide for charitable giving? How do you think about them?
I think there's been a tremendous evolution in how, I would say, the industry or the sector thinks about overhead. We used to say you want to have really, really low overheads and eliminate all overhead costs, and every dollar should go into the primary program. The problem with that is it's a little bit, it's short-term thinking in many regards, because these are professional organizations paying staff. And if you cut back the overhead so much, you essentially starve the organization. Mm. Radically out of alignment overhead. So if you have an organization where 20% of their money goes to the program and 80% goes to fundraising and administrative costs, I'd walk away, right? That's not a good ratio. But cost per outcome is a different way of looking at the situation. You're saying, I have an intervention like cataract surgery, and that I know it's going to cost on average, you know, but there's good literature that cataract surgery is a great way of preventing blindness in developed and undeveloped countries. It's something that, you know, people with less means often can't afford it. So helping someone get cataract surgery is a way of preserving eyesight. So we see the sort of the end goal is preserving eyesight. You then you do some average costing of, well, organization A can save, you know, do cataract surgery for, you know, let's say $100 per patient. I'm making up these numbers.
Sure, sure.
And organization B is doing it for $150 per person. Well, then organization A is more efficient in that case. We agree, we're factoring out all other possible differences. We're saying that the interventions are good, and we have proof of that based on, you know, the research we've done in the organizations. And then efficiency makes sense in that case, because, you know, your $100 is actually enough to preserve one person's eyesight, whereas it's not quite enough with organization B. So that's where it's a different way of looking at efficiencies, but I think it's important.
We're talking about how to make sure your charitable donations are well spent. Michael Thatcher is here, who leads Charity Navigator. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Michael, something I'm curious about, because you expanded your rating system to include DEI commitments from these charities. And, you know, it might be early as you work with evaluating this kind of data, but what are you learning there about charities and diversity, equity, inclusion goals and values?
So I think what we're learning right now is that sort of the DEI, it's a journey. And so some organizations, that's almost their identity. Right. That is they're working on equity as their primary focus. Mm-hmm. And other organizations are, let's stay with cataract surgery. Right. That isn't necessarily focused on changing social norms. It's focused on preserving eyesight. But there is an equity. There's a diversity equity practice. Are they paying fairly within the different demographics of the organization themselves? How are they posting job advertisements? Are, you know, salaries listed? Are the how and what, you know, going back to your initial question, what are we seeing? We're seeing we've got roughly 30,000 organizations that have provided input on these set of questions. There are 14 equity practices that are collected by GuideStar by Candid. So they are a partner organization of ours. And we're then scoring that and giving extra points for people that are exhibiting more than three practices. There's tremendous room for growth, both in the number of charities that actually report this information, and then within that, Of the 14, I would say statistically, there's the majority are only less than, it's about five, between three and five. So there's, we have a lot of room to grow in this area.
Okay. Kevin in Richland Center with a question. Kevin, hi, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I have 2 points. Take one or both of them if you have the time. One of them is you mentioned you want to ensure that your organization is a nonprofit. And I'm not really sure the legal definition between a profit or a nonprofit organization, but I do notice that one of your features is to reveal the salaries of some key personnel. And in some of these charities, the CEOs are making well into the 6 figures, close to $1 million. So that kind of begs a question as far as how well our dollars are being spent. And the other question that I had is, I'm curious if the charities that are rated have to pay a fee to you to rate them, because I did check a charity and didn't find it, and it's a pretty well-known large charity. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Kevin, great questions. Thank you. Michael, go ahead.
Sure. Great questions. And I'll start with the question about is it a charity? So there are different types of charitable organizations within the US tax code. The ones that we have ratings on and the ones that you can actually get a tax break with your gift are what we call 501c3 organizations. You also have 501c4 organizations, which are more the lobbying entities. And where it can get confusing is that there are a number of charities that have both a C3 and a C4, because one of the aspects of being a C3 charity is that you're not allowed to engage in the political process. You can advocate for your organization, but you can't advocate for a political party or individual. And so that's where that can get a little bit confusing. With regard to CEO salary, that's a data point that is all charities must report. It's on their tax forms, and those are public documents. And so we do surface that information. What we've found is that the it's not we haven't found a way of actually saying makes the charity more or less effective. What we're beginning to look at, and there's actually some really interesting data here, though it's harder for us to get both. What you want to know is the range between highest paid individual and lowest paid individual with an organization. And sometimes that can be like a 16 times number. That seems a bit outlandish. I don't, and again, what we're trying to do is show you why this is important, and then we'll include it in the rating. We haven't been able to ascertain that with CEO salary, but we list it because for many donors, that's a trigger point, and there's a feeling of, I actually don't want to be giving to an organization that's paying their executive that much money.
That final question there, do these nonprofits pay a fee to be rated by you?
Oh, great. I'm sorry, I missed that. I should have hit that one right away.
No, that's okay.
No, we're a 20-year-old organization, and our founding principle is never charge the charity, never charge the donor. So we stick by that. We've changed a lot over 20 years, but we don't want to, that could potentially bring in some kind of a bias or a favoritism, and we want to keep it as pure as we can. So no, we won't be charging any charities.
Charity Navigator CEO Michael Thatcher, our guide to evaluating a charity's effectiveness and reliability. Join in with your questions about donating to charities or how you approach personal philanthropy, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss how to make informed donations to charities, how to evaluate your donation to a nonprofit, and what to watch out for with scams. Join in on what you think about what you check before you make a charitable contribution, 800-642-1234. Michael Thatcher is CEO of the organization Charity Navigator and stays with us. Michael, let's focus now on 990s. Nonprofits required to fill out 990 tax forms with the IRS. What information is in these forms?
There's a ton of information within the 990, but you have all of the basic, you know, where's the office, number of employees, where they spend their money. The IRS asks charities to separate out how much money goes to program, how much money goes to administrative costs, and how much money goes to fundraising. You also have quite a few what we call accountability and transparency metrics in there. So do you have a whistleblower policy? Do you have a privacy policy? Is there a compensation process or evaluation for the CEO compensation? You also list in the 990 what your mission is, what you do to achieve that mission. There is the basic form, and then there are a bunch of additional schedules that get added depending on the nature of the organization. You could be, for example, private foundations file 990s, working charities, C3s file 990s, and the other split is depending on the size of the organization, and size as measured by number of dollars that you bring in on an annual basis, you're going to be filing a slightly different form. So tiny organizations that are under $50,000 in annual revenue are generally filing what's called a 990 PF, which is, it's like a postcard. It's basically saying, I'm still here.
I'm still active.
Still active, still alive. You've got to file it every year. Otherwise you get pulled out of the database. Once you're over 200,000, you're filing the full form. And then and depending on the nature of your business, you'll fill out different schedules.
Do you think, is it worthwhile for a donor to check out the 990 form before donating?
Well, yes and no, in the sense that it depends on how much you want to get involved in the organization and what they're doing. What Charity Navigator tries to do is make that, we pull out sort of the basic information and put it into a common and easier to read, or let's say more humanly readable format. Mm-hmm. And what I would do is I would look first at a platform like Charity Navigator. And then if you have additional questions, generally, one of the metrics that we request of charities is that they post their 990 on their website. It's a public document. It should be easily available. And so, you know, come check us out, see what you see in terms of our rating. Does it give you enough information to make your choice? If so, proceed. If you need more, then go to their website, pull down their 990 and read through it. I would advise folks, maybe, you know, once or twice, take a look at the form and you'll realize why a platform like Charity Navigator is really helpful, because it's a pain. It's like, well, we all file a 1040, right? And it's similar looking document. It's not made for afternoon reading, let's say.
Well, I want to run scams by you, because we see the news stories and law enforcement, they bring attention to charity scams. How common is it for nonprofits to run scams or to commit fraud?
So you gave the Urban Institute's number of about, what is it, 1.8 million right
yes,
now.
Yes, indeed.
Part of what Charity Navigator does is also alert prospective donors to possible scams. And we have an advisory system with low, medium, and high level alerts. And on average, we've got about 400 alerts running, and that's across the rated and unrated universe. So that's a low number. Now, the other thing that I've observed over time is that most scams aren't being run by charities. They're being run by scammers, right? These are crooks that they're out to steal your money. They're not going to waste their time and get legal IRS status for the most part. That will occasionally happen, but they'll tend to be pop-up scams that happen at a time of crisis. Hmm. So something something unfortunate happens in the world, any part of the world, and there'll be a huge outpouring of giving, because people, we care about each other, and we naturally do that. The problem with that is that if you, that's particularly where people are vulnerable, because you don't necessarily, for example, the war in Ukraine, mm-hmm. most Americans wouldn't have known where to give to Ukraine refugees 12 months ago, right? Mm-hmm. Now there's a multitude of organizations that are doing work there. There are also scams with regard to the relief effort for the Ukrainians. That's I think where, or again, this is where I think Charity Navigator really can add value, because we're going to help you find legitimate organizations that are engaged in that, and you can avoid the scam that way.
I just want to reintroduce you here for a moment. Michael Thatcher, the CEO of Charity Navigators. We talk about charitable giving and what to know about nonprofits. I want to squeeze this in because I know we're slightly running short on time here. If I make an online donation, how do I make sure the charity's website is secure and that my personal privacy is protected?
That is a really good question. And that's hard for me to answer as charity per charity. What I can provide you with is a potential alternative, and that is Charity Navigator has a giving basket. We don't charge for it. You can run the transaction through our giving basket. The other thing that's a nice safety about our giving basket is that we won't let you give to a fake charity. So just look for the giving basket on, you know, that you find the organization you want to support, you find them, and in there, there'll be a donate button. And our donations are secure. We're working with Give Lively that provides the processing, the back-end processing. So we don't process the credit card information ourselves, and it goes directly to the organization that you've chosen.
And in our last moments together, if a cause is really important to you, and let's say you've been giving to the cause for years now, what are ways that you can make sure your ongoing donations are actually making a difference?
One of the best ways to really, if you believe in a charity and you've supported them for a number of years, is build a relationship. Don't, not just a monetary one, but go volunteer, get to know someone in the organization. And the other thing that I think is a way of, this is something that the charities will appreciate, consider signing up for a recurring gift. And that would mean, rather than making a one lump sum amount at a different, you know, let's say this time of year, sign up for regular withdrawals, monthly withdrawals from your credit card at a lower amount, but within your annual budget, and that'll make them happy, and it'll also you'll be increasing your engagement through systematic donations to them.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Kate.
Michael Thatcher is president and CEO of Charity Navigator, rating charities and nonprofits to determine how effective they are. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.